There were three outstanding qualities in the life of this man, Hosea. All of them begin with the letters C-O-M. We've looked at the first one, command. He was under the command of God. Now we're going to move in to look at the second one, which I'm not going to tell you what the word is at the moment, but the clue to it is here in Hosea chapter 1, verse 2, where it says, when the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord. Now, the scripture makes it very clear that in a very definite sense, God is married to his people. And as we go through these three chapters, we need to keep in mind three parallel marriages. There is Hosea, the husband, and Gomer, the wife. There is God, the husband, and Israel, the wife. And there is Jesus, the husband, and there is myself. Romans 7:4, you became dead to the law by the body of Christ, that you might be married to another, even to him who is raised from the dead. So three parallel marriages to keep in mind. In each case, there's no question about the integrity of the husband. And that which is under examination is the behavior of the wife. How do we know that God was married to Israel in a real sense? There are several statements concerning that. I'll just give you two of them. Isaiah 54, verse 5. Your maker is your husband. It's a statement made through Isaiah to the nation of Israel and Judah. Your maker is your husband. And then Jeremiah 31, verse 32. They broke my covenant, even though I was a faithful husband unto them. Jeremiah 31, 32. They broke my covenant, even though I was a faithful husband unto them. Now, Hosea married Gomer, and he lived with her. And every day he loved her. Every day he looked for a response of love towards him. Every day he tried to establish a two-way relationship. He gave her his name when they were married, his reputation. He gave her a home. He gave her her food. He gave her his protection. He gave her her clothing. He gave her her jewelry. Everything she had, she got from him. And day by day, he lavished his love upon her, did everything that he could by way of taking care of her, and all he got was betrayal, heartbreak, insult, degradation. And he lived with that. We don't know how long, we're not told how long. We're not told it ever became any different. And if you can put yourself in Hosea's place, what a terrible position to be in. Maybe you can think back, some of you, to some time when you had a crush on somebody else who perhaps didn't even know you existed. And you ate your heart out thinking, smiled at them, left little gifts for them or whatever, and they didn't even know you were there. They just walked right on by. Or maybe even worse, they knew you were there, but they never encouraged you, never smiled at you, never spoke to you, just ignored you, or deliberately insulted you, made fun of you, put you down. And it hurts when you love somebody like that, doesn't it? Because you're open to being hurt. Now, you won't appreciate why at first, but you will, I'm sure, by the time we get to the end of the class. I want us to look in Luke's Gospel, chapter 15, at the world's best known short story. And the world's best known short story is the prodigal son, as we call him. Jesus was an absolute master communicator. And so the stories he told are still told today, even though they weren't written down at the time. Luke 15, verse 1 says this: "Now the tax collectors and sinners," in quotation marks, "were all gathering around to hear him." The tax collectors had betrayed their country and were constantly ceremonially defiled by mixing with the heathen, so they could never go in the temple, they could never worship, they were regarded as traitors and as scum, scarcely human. So were the, quote, sinners, the obvious public sinners, the thieves, bandits, prostitutes, etc. And all these kind of people came to Jesus Christ, and they loved to be with him, and they loved to listen to him, and they opened their homes to him. Verse 2, "But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, 'Ugh! This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" Ugh, how disgusting. How can you associate with people like that? And these sort of proud, self-righteous, religious people, the leaders of the established religious orders, sort of looked down on these people, and they looked down on Jesus Christ for associating with them. So verse 3 says, "Then Jesus told them this parable," and in fact told them three parables. The one we're looking at now begins in verse 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided the property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living." So it's a sort of story that these religious folk could relate to. And the key to understanding the story is the situation in which it was told. It was told in a conflict situation to the religious leaders who criticized Jesus for associating with thieves, prostitutes, etc. And the story begins, there is a father who has two sons. And in the original setting, the father represents God, and the two sons represent two Jews. For our purpose, they're two Christians. But they already have a relationship to the Father, their sons. They're already in the family. It is not an evangelistic story. It was never meant to be. It might be valid to use it as an illustration of an evangelistic point, but it was never its primary purpose. And the father has two sons, and as usually happens, when a father has two sons, one is older than the other one. And if you think it out carefully, that means that the other one was younger than the first one. And this was so, and not only in the matter of years, but also in the matter of maturity. And the youngest son doesn't like it much at home. It's kind of tedious, and it's sort of boring at home. But the youngest son knows, although it's boring at home, he knows it's exciting in a far country. Man, there are all kinds of things you can do in a distant country when you get away from home, or when you get away from dad's influence, or when you get away from all the neighbors that know you and that know your car license plates and everything. When you get over there, man, the things you can do are so much fun. Provided you have money. You've got to have money. If you don't have money, no fun. If you've got money, boy, you can really live it up. And this kid just has one problem. See, he's no money. Dad is loaded, but he doesn't have any. Now, of course, he knows that one day his dad will die, and when his dad dies, the inheritance will be divided between him and his older brother, and he'll get a share of it. The only thing is, the old boy looks in awfully good health. You know, he's going to go on forever. And by the time he finally snuffs it, this kid will be so old, he'll be too old to enjoy himself. So he can't wait for his dad to die. It's going to take too long. And he's not quite the kind of kid that wants to bump his father off, actually. But his thinking is really like this. Let's pretend that dad's dead already. Now, if dad were dead already, I would get my inheritance now, which is exactly what I want. So, of course, he's a little bit too smart to go to his father and say, hey, dad, let's pretend you're dead. You know, his dad probably wouldn't go over that for real big. So he wraps it up in language that sounds, you know, a little bit more polite, like, father, give to me the portion of goods that falleth to me. It sounds better when you put it like that, doesn't it? I mean, all teenagers know how to manipulate their parents. They learned that when they were about 2 and a half, and they've just developed the technique a little bit longer. And so he comes to his father, and he says, I would like to have my share of the inheritance now. And his father is far too wise to think that love and loyalty are the sort of things that can be compelled. You can't compel anybody to love you. Can't compel anybody to be loyal to you. And so he does what the kid says. And he divides his inheritance and gives the kid his share. Now, you can tell he is younger by his language. See, all we've ever heard him say up to this point is this, Father, give me. That's all he said. And there is a kind of younger Christian who has never grown up. And all you ever hear him say when he talks to his father, which isn't very often, but when the immature Christian talks to his Heavenly Father, the entire content of his language can be summed up by those three words, Father, give me. He has never yet thought to say, Father, is there something you want to say to me today? Father, is there something you see in me that isn't good and needs to be put right? Father, is there something that I could do for you today that will bring joy to your heart? Can I please you in some way? How can I serve you? It's not even occurred to him to talk like that. He's a spiritual baby, and all the Father exists for is you can get things out of the Father. Father, give me. And to him, the Father isn't even a person. He's a non-personal automat. You learn how to manipulate the right button, and you get what you want. Like one of these automats that will serve you hot soup, hot chocolate, coffee, black, white, with sugar, etc. If you punch the right button, you get what you want. And there are people who treat God just like that. What can I get out of him today? And they've not yet learned that he has a heart, that he's a person. He's got feelings that are being considered. No way. What can I get today? So he gets what he wants, and in the short space of time it takes him to get the kind of clothes he wants. You know, some very scruffy, battered-looking jeans and an exceptionally smart outfit for special parties, and kind of car he wants to go off in, he's gone. Doesn't even look back down the road as he goes. But while he goes, his father stands at the doorway and watches him leave. And he's still a father. As an awful wrench in his heart as he watches his son disappear in a cloud of dust. And he wonders what's going to happen to him. And the kind of people that Jesus was talking to could relate to this, because they were probably middle-aged men, fairly well-to-do, fairly affluent, with rebellious sons, because home was a bit boring for those kind of sons, with those kind of fathers. So he's gone. And when he gets to the far country, because he's got a lot of money, he really has a great time. He really lives it up. And he collects around him a huge host of cheap friends. It's very easy to get cheap friends if you've got plenty of money, because cheap friends are always expensive. And as long as he's got money and he can splash it around, everybody's prepared to help him do it. And he's got lots of folks who'll slap him on the back, shake him by the hand, and they'll drink his whiskey or whatever else, and they'll share in his parties, and he'll get invited to other parties. It's a good time, great time. Not a good time, great time. And you would never guess from his behavior that he's his father's son. He is. And not for one second does he stop being his father's son. No. Wherever he is, whatever town he's in, whoever he's sleeping with tonight, he is still his father's son. And wherever he goes, he carries his father's name and his father's reputation. And to watch him behave, you wouldn't know that he was his father's son, but he is. And of course, there's plenty of Christians like that. You would never guess from their behavior that they were Christians. But they are. And wherever they go, and whatever they do, they carry their father's name and their reputation. And his reputation is set on you, Christian. And whatever you do affects it. And the devil is watching. And so are a whole host of witnesses, too many to count. Even when you think you're in a room by yourself, they're there. And his name is upon you. Well, before very long, of course, the resources run out. They always do in the far country, you know. And there's a great famine. Their resources are pretty limited. It's an awful bankrupt society. It just looks affluent from a distance. When you get into it, you find just how bankrupt they really are. And he begins to be in need, desperate need, and then he's got to do something terrible. He has got to work. It's a bad word for a kid like that. And of course, he's in a heathen country already. And these proud Jews that Jesus is talking to sort of curl up inside at the thought of this beautiful Jewish boy turning his back on his Jewish inheritance and mixing with this rabble of a heathen people. And their hearts are very sympathetic to the father and to the kid as well, and I think how awful to be contaminated like that. And as he looks for work, the only work he can get is for a heathen farmer, so he has to go to work for a heathen. Now, the Jews didn't mind too much employing the heathen to work for them, but to be a Jew and to work under a heathen, that was pretty bad. And this thoughtless, heartless heathen, he wasn't just a heathen, but he made this Jewish kid keep pigs. You know. Now, it isn't just that the pig isn't particularly very high on the social ranking. You know, there's a bit more to it than that. The pig was an unclean animal for the Jew. You know, hence the saying, as unpopular as a bacon sandwich in a synagogue. And the Jews didn't eat pig meat. They weren't allowed to. And this was either particularly insensitive or particularly cruel of this heathen man to make this Jewish kid feed his pigs. And now you can see the shock reaction on these people that Jesus is talking to, and they're going, oh, how awful. How could that heathen man do such a disgusting thing? That poor kid and that poor father eating his heart out back there at home. And then Jesus hasn't quite finished with them there, and he says, you know, that kid, he was so hungry. He was just starving. His ribs were sticking out through his skin. And he would just love to have got in the trough and elbowed those pigs out of the way and eaten their food. Well, of course, anybody who knows anything about pigs knows that's kind of dangerous. You know, pigs don't share their food all that regularly. If you don't believe me, go to the dining room for breakfast tomorrow morning. You'll find out. And you'll find one or two in there. So now the Jesus listeners are just grossed out. You know, it's terrible. And you wouldn't think, looking at that kid, skinny, ragged, barefoot, desperately hungry, you wouldn't think that his dad was a millionaire, but he is. It's just a long time since he had much to do with his father. And plenty of Christians, you look at them and they're so skinny, spiritually speaking. Their lives are so shriveled and poverty-stricken and empty, you wouldn't know that their father was the Almighty. You wouldn't know that they were related to the God of all grace. And the God whose love planned Calvary. They are. They just don't have too much to do with them. And so they're skinny and undernourished and hungry. And they even think about the pig pen as a way of getting a bit of nourishment. And finally does some thinking. It's always a good thing to do. You know, you're allowed to use your intellect as a child of God. He gave it to you in the first place. Use it. And he does a little bit of thinking and thinks, man, isn't this crazy? Here am I plodding around barefoot in this pig swamp, starving, and there are fat servants in my father's house. They've got more food than they know what to do with. And I'm a son, and I belong there. And here am I, in this stinking hovel. The only thing is, I've blown it. I really don't have any right to go back there. I've no right to call myself his son anymore. And he's sort of getting towards the truth. He doesn't have any right to call himself the father's son, but then he never was worth it, was he? Was he worthy of being his father's son when he lived there and didn't like it? He wasn't worth it then. But it's not a question of being worth it, is it? Are we God's children because we're worth it, or because he's gracious? And out of his free unbounded goodness, he's adopted us into his family and caused us to be born by Spirit. Did we merit it? Or did he just give it? He said, I've sinned. I've sinned against Dad, against heaven. I'm no more worthy to be called his son, but maybe he'd make me a servant. I'll go back and ask him. And so he sets off home. And he has got this carefully prepared speech. And he's rehearsed it on the way home. And he's a very difficult person to recognize from the one who left home. See, he left home
head high, roaring off in a cloud of dust, going to seek adventure, proud, self-reliant, smart clothes. He's coming back ragged, barefoot, limping, thin, dirty, the muck from the pig pen still all over him. Very difficult to recognize, but his father recognizes him while he's still a long way away. Why does he recognize him? Well, because he's been looking for him every day. See, not only has that kid never stopped being his father's son, the father has never stopped being a father. That's one of the things about being a father. Once you become a father, you're always a father. And the father's been up on the flat roof, looking away off into the distance. Maybe today my son's going to come home. I wonder what's happening to him. Asking everybody who comes from the far countries, what's going on out there? When he hears there's a famine, he's desperately anxious. And all these Jews identify with the father and his longing. And so the day comes when he's looking off into the distance, and way off in the distance he sees this scruffy, ragged, limping figure dragging himself up the road, and he knows immediately who it is. And the New Testament uses a kind of unusual word for an adult. He says he ran to meet him. You know, as we said this morning, jogging wasn't in fashion, and adults weren't built for running. They were overweight, if they could afford to be, and he could afford to be. Not only was he overweight, their clothes weren't designed for it. They were sort of long, flowing things, like ball dresses or maxi dresses or something. You try running down the road in one of those, you run up the inside of the thing instead of running down the road. And it's very undignified. And you've got the impression of this old man falling over himself in his enthusiasm to get to his son as he returns home. And this is a picture of the Almighty. And the way he feels toward people like you and me, and the way he longs over us, and the way he yearns over us. And the son starts off his little prepared speech, but he never finishes it. And the father flings himself on him, and he hugs him, and he kisses him, and he starts shouting out instructions. You can almost see the neighbors drawing aside their lace curtains. What's going on out there? What's that old guy doing? This is a respectable neighborhood. We don't behave like that, shouting out there. Hire a dance band! Boy, it's amazing how unspiritual Jesus was sometimes. Kill the fatted calf, we're going to have a barbecue. Send out the invitations, get the neighbors in. And all the servants go into a flurry of activity. And the dance band come and they play, and it's pretty lively stuff. And the people really have a ball. And, they're having a good time. The place is alive with lights and bonfires, and the whole calf is being roasted, and everybody's celebrating. And the older son comes in from the field. And when he gets near to the house, he hears music and dancing. It's a pretty big farm. You see, in those days, it was quiet. There were no transistors, no radio sets, no TV sets, no motorbikes, no car. It was quiet. There was no machinery. They were Amish people. And not only that, people had good hearing. And it was a quiet landscape, and people had good hearing because they hadn't wrecked it. And it wasn't until he got near the house they heard the music and the dancing. It's a pretty big farm. When he heard the music and the dancing, and he saw the place ablaze with lights, he thought, what on earth's going on there? We don't do that in our house. You know? Maybe the Romans have taken over or something. And he sees one of the servants and he says, hey you, What's going on there? Why are all the lights on? And the servant says, why, sir? Your brother's come home. Father's so excited, he's killed a fatted calf, having a party. Man, it's a party. You better hurry up and join us. And a kind of cold rage fills his heart. He says, you can just tell my father I won't be there. So the servant relays the message to the father, and the father tears himself away from his newly returned son, turns himself away from the first party in years, comes out into the darkness to meet his older son, who is also a son. And he says, what's the matter, son? Why don't you come and join us? And the older son says, I'll tell you why. You have just got no concept of justice whatever, have you? Here am I work my fingers to the bone about your farm. I do everything you want me to do. I carry out all your instructions. I never do anything I'm not supposed to do. I've got an absolutely spotless reputation. And what do I get out of it? Nothing. Not one scruffy, scrawny, skinny, scraggy little goat. Nothing. And then this son of yours comes home. He's a great character, isn't he? Drags your name through the mud of goodness knows how many cities, sleeps with anybody he likes to, squanders your wealth, and brings back nothing. What does he get? The biggest party the neighborhood's ever seen. If that's justice, if that's fairness, I don't want to know. And the old man smiles gently, and he says, son, you're always with me, and everything that I have is yours. You ever notice that? That's God speaking. Everything that I have is yours. Son, what kind of a father do you think I am? Do you think I'm the kind of father, son, who likes to stay at home and see you out of some miserable sense of duty, dragging along, just working, 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 never smiling, never enjoying anything? You don't enjoy your work, and you don't know how to play. You've never had a party? That calf is yours. You could have killed it yesterday and had a party. You never asked me. Do you think I'm the sort of father, son, who is just a cold, non-personal slave driver who just wants his instructions carried out to the letter, and that's all he's interested in? You think that's the kind of father I am? Son, let me ask you a question. When you came home and you saw the place ablaze with lights and you heard the music and the dancing, son, did you know what it was? Or did you have to ask? I mean, don't tell me, son, that you live in my house, eat at my table every day, work at my business every day, keep my rules every day, but you don't know me. That you never saw how quiet I went when your brother went away. When you never saw how I grieved over him and yearned for him and longed for him and asked all the travelers what was going on and went up to the housetop and looked off into the distance. Don't tell me, son, that you lived in my heart and you didn't lived in my house and you didn't know my heart. Don't tell me, son, that though you're in my house every day, you're a perfect stranger. Because this man is a Pharisee. He's praying every day, he's in the temple every day, he keeps all the rules, and he works about God's business, but he doesn't know the heart of God. And because they didn't know the heart of God, they couldn't understand why Jesus was excited and thrilled to be thieves and prostitutes and tax collectors. They're total strangers to the heart of God. And what God was doing with Hosea was he was bringing him right into his heart. as Hosea experienced day after day, the heartbreak and the agony and the despair of setting his love on a prostitute. Somebody who insisted on degrading and debasing herself. Somebody who never returned his love. And he felt the agony in his own heart. He began to understand how it was for God to love Israel. And for God to watch Israel as he said, "No, God, I'm going to worship Molech today. I'm going to burn my baby in the fire. No, God, I'm not going to worship you today. I am going to worship Baal and commit adultery with one of his priestesses. No, God, I'm not going to worship you today. I'm going to commit adultery with one of the priests of Ashtaroth. Ashtaroth is my God. Baal is my God. Molech is my God. My bike is my God. My truck is my God. My camera is my God. My basketball is my God. My girlfriend's my God. My man is my God. My farm's my God. My family's my God. I don't have time to worship you. I've got another God." And as Hosea experienced day by day by day by day the heartbreak of that marriage, he began to understand exactly how God felt towards Israel. And the whole story of this theme, this story in Luke, is that neither son knew the father. For one, he was a non-personal giving machine. For the other, he was a non-personal slave driver. But neither of them actually knew the heart of God. Now I want to ask you a personal question. Do you know the heart of God? To what extent do you know the heart of God? Do you know why Jesus left heaven and came to earth? Do you know why he wept at the tomb of Lazarus? Do you understand why he lamented and grieved over Jerusalem, even though he knew they were going to crucify him and they hated him and just wanted to get rid of him? Or is there some foreign concept to you? You see, when you come to know the heart of God, you know his yearning and his longing over a lost world. It's not just disgusting when people go into the depths of sin. It's destroying. Love rejoices not in iniquity. And your heart begins to yearn over people who are lost. All levels of people, rich and poor. You don't just regard the drug addict as a fool. But you long to reach out to him and rescue him. And if you're going to get to know the heart of God, I want to tell you something, it'll be very, very costly. You'll never again be able to live the way you once lived. You'll never be able to spend your money the way you once spent it. You'll never be able to waste your time the way you once wasted it, and your energies. Because you'll be driven by a yearning, burning, near desperate desire to reach out to a world that is lost. And the Lord of the harvest will thrust you out into his harvest because the love of Christ will constrain you. And the love of Christ is a self-sacrificing love that will do anything to rescue those who hate him. If you want to sail through life without a care in the world and just a happy hallelujah every now and again, don't get to know the heart of God. You'll never be able to do it. But of course, neither will you really live either. You'll just exist in a nice little psychedelic bubble of your own. If you get together with enough people who are just the same, you can think the world is like that. But it isn't. 1 billion people in the world today. Suffer from malnutrition. 1,000 million people have some kind of physical deformity because they can't afford to eat. And that's the world that Jesus Christ loves. And if that affects you, there are more people than that at the moment on their way to spend eternity in hell. And that's real. And it's a vastly greater tragedy that they would spend eternity in hell than that they would be physically deformed because they can't afford to eat. It's just easier to picture than being deformed. How sensitive are you really toward the world of lost people and to the purpose of Jesus Christ in coming to seek and to save those who are lost and to give his life a ransom for many? And until the same love motivates you and you're prepared to give your life a ransom, even though, of course, you cannot pay the ransom, but unless you're prepared to give your life for their sake, you won't really know what it is to live. The love of Christ constrains us. Is that what you want? The heart of God is a heart that beats. And the heart of Hosea is a heart that beats. And as he came to know the yearning and the longing and the heartbreak and the heartache, he began to get close to God and for his heart to beat in tune with the heart of God. And that's what it takes to be a servant of God. It's not enough to know the message. You have to know the one who sent you with that message. And you have to know what is in his heart. The letter isn't enough. So the second word is the word, and we're using it in an unusual sense, the word compassion. And that word is best understood if you break it down into its two halves, compassion. You know what passion means? In modern English, we tend to use it more in terms of a love affair or something like that. It's a valid use. It's not the only one. When we talk about the passion of Christ, what do we mean? I mean his sufferings and his death. And passion means any very, very deep feeling of any kind. It comes from the Greek word pathos, meaning feeling. Passion, a very deep feeling. Com means together. So we're talking about a very deep feeling together. Okay? When it says that Jesus had compassion on the leper, it doesn't mean that he was sorry for him. It meant that he was able to think his way right into the situation of the leper and to actually feel what the leper was feeling. And we're using this in a sense, the opposite way around. Hosea had compassion with God. He was able to enter in right into the heart of God and to know how God felt towards his people, Israel. so the first quality of Hosea as a servant of God was he was under the command of God. He learned how to take orders, and he did. Second, he had compassion with God. He not only knew the instructions, but he knew the heart of the one who was sending him. And he shared the longing of God for the repentance and the restoration of his people. Okay. So let's stop there and let's pray together.